From McMaster University, I'm John Preston, and you're listening to Big Ideas for a Changing World. In this series, you'll hear from researchers from McMaster's Faculty of Engineering and beyond who are creating innovative solutions to our world's greatest challenges. I have the chance to see some of these solutions up close as the faculty's Associate Dean for Research and External Relations. Today, we're delving into the latest research on cloth masks or face coverings. We'll hear how far we've come in determining which materials and designs work best to protect against COVID-19, but also how researchers at McMaster are helping to advance Canadian standards for masks. You'll hear from two researchers from the Faculty of Engineering and two researchers from the Faculty of Health Science. As part of McMaster's Center of Excellence in Protective Equipment and Materials, this group of researchers has spearheaded mask testing efforts in Canada since the start of the pandemic. With that, a warm welcome to our guests on Big Ideas for a Changing World.
My name is Catherine Place. I'm a kidney doctor in the Department of Medicine and a member of the Department of Health Research Methods here at McMaster. I usually work on the optimal use of drugs for people with chronic kidney disease. And from a methods perspective, my experience is in how to review and synthesize information from a number of different primary publications.
I'm Myrna Dolovich. I'm an engineer in the Professor of Medicine in the Faculty of Health Sciences at McMaster. I'm based though at St. Joseph's Hospital, where I have my aerosol research lab. We do testing drug delivery devices and various aspects of aerosol drug delivery to patients.
My name is Charles Delanois. I'm an assistant professor in chemical engineering at McMaster University. My research straddles both chemical engineering and environmental engineering, where we primarily focus on developing novel technologies for environmental remediation, water treatment, wastewater treatment, desalination, and in some contexts, remediation of soils and contaminated environments.
I'm Zainab Hosseinidous. I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Chemical Engineering. The focus of my research is translational bacteriophage research. So I work with the bacteriophages. These are viruses that infect bacteria, so they're good viruses. They can be used as alternatives to antibiotics. And the aim is to generate the knowledge and the tools to move from the wealth of information developed by basic scientists, microbiologists, to move this information into the clinic. And so there are gaps in knowledge in between that we address.
Before we get into the research on cloth masks, I'd like to break down how COVID-19 transmission happens and what role masks play in preventing that. Can one of you describe this for us?
The modes of transmission for COVID-19 viruses, it is still a conversation that is in play. There's airborne transmission, and then there are droplets, fomite transmission. And they really involve different parts of the aerosols that are released when you are coughing, sneezing, laughing, talking, singing in front of somebody who may or may not be infected. So the larger droplets in the aerosol, those that are greater than, say, 10, 15, 20 micrometers in size, will sediment reasonably quickly out of the aerosol cloud onto surfaces that are present in the area that has been exposed. So chairs, tables, whatever is there. And if people touch them in a certain period of time, they may or may not be infected. The other aspect is airborne transmission, and this is related to the very ultrafine part of the aerosol cloud, nanoparticles that remain in suspension in the air, and they travel with air currents and remain in the atmosphere of the room or wherever it may be happening, restaurants, etc., shops. And these can be inhaled over time with people that are in that area. So it's important to recognize that there is now the consideration of the airborne transmission as the main mode of transmission for COVID-19 virus. And the fomite exposure is less of an issue. And I think you would see that in the literature as well that is coming out. So masks are important for both. And we need to be able to understand that we have to protect ourselves and protect those around us from exposure to the virus and from inhaling the virus. And that's done with face masks.
More and more evidence is showing that not only are the public protected from someone exhaling the virus by wearing a mask, but also the wearer can also be protected in some degree from the public exhaling the virus on them. And the way that works is if a virus leaves your nose or your mouth through a sneeze or through a cough, then as Myrna, as Dr. Dulovich mentioned, the viruses are encapsulated in a variety of different sizes of aerosols. So you can have large droplets, you can have small aerosols, which are air-carried vapor droplets. And if you have very large droplets, then the mask simply acts as a sieve or a barrier. So kind of like if you're separating pasta from water using a sieve, that mesh helps trap those larger particles. Smaller particles are not going to be captured like pasta through a sieve. They will be able to, in some degree, travel through that sieve. But a properly designed mask that's of multi-layers or that is a complex web of very fine fibers increases the chance that a very small particle will eventually hit a mask fiber. And the more complex web, the more what we call tortuous the path, the more time the virus spends trying to travel and weave its way through that mask, the more chance there is for impacting that virus with material within the mask. So that's generally how masks work. And the real challenge is to design a mask that has a very high number of tortuous pathways. So a very high number of routes for the virus to have to travel through in order that the possibility of hitting a fiber is greater and greater and greater without impacting the breathability of that mask. That means without making it so difficult to breathe through it that air escapes out the side. So that's primarily for the transmission of a cougher or a sneezer through the mask they're wearing. Now for the other side, for the public or for airborne aerosolized viruses that might exist in the atmosphere, a mask is the same thing. It's, you know, it can also prevent the virus from diffusing, from getting through the mask into your mouth and nose. And that's very effective. But as we've seen, you can also get the virus through other orifices, for example, your eyes, or if you touch something and then touch your mouth later. So it's not 100% effective to protect you from the outside environment, but it really does reduce some of the main modes of transmission.
Catherine, a few months ago, you and your team published a review of various filtration properties of cloth masks. How did you get into this area of mask testing as a nephrologist? Can you summarize your main findings for us?
Back in March, we realized that patients who are treated with hemodialysis in dialysis centers would be uniquely at risk. They're a group of patients who have very high levels of comorbidity to start with, so they would be very vulnerable to the disease. And then they have to come to a dialysis facility 3 times every week, and the physical layout of our dialysis facilities is completely fixed. So ideally, we were thinking we would want to adopt universal masking. That is, the staff wear a mask, patients wear a mask throughout the entire treatment. And we thought that that would likely mitigate the risk based on evidence that we had from healthcare workers. But at that point, we didn't have enough personal protective equipment to even consider doing that. And so I started thinking, I can make cloth masks. We were looking at people in China using improvised PPE on the news. And I thought, I can make cloth masks. My church group, they'll make cloth masks. So I started looking at the papers that everybody was reading at the same time. And then I started digging back into the literature and trying to find everything that had been published comprehensively. And then when we realized that cloth was potentially really useful, at that point, the pandemic or first wave was really out of control. So we put together a group of epidemiologists to write an opinion paper saying that cloth masks should be used in the pandemic, even though we didn't have good evidence from randomized trials to show that they worked. So we thought that the balance of the risks and benefits really favored their immediate use. And I met Myrna and she joined that group and we published that paper. Then we went on to summarize in a more formal way all the information that we'd found, which made a very long paper. We realized we were novices in the field, so we really wanted it to go through peer review. We didn't put it on a preprint server. We were patient. We went through, we had 4 reviews. They were all quite challenging. They were all quite answerable. And eventually we had our review paper published. And at the same point as that being published, we published our plain language equivalent, which is our website, clothmasks.ca. And what are the best masks? According to the literature, they're 2 to 4 layer cotton, at least 100 threads to the inch, probably around 150 grams per square meter, certainly not a lightweight material, something more like a t-shirt or a tea towel than like a bed sheet.
Charles, you've been working on identifying the features of cloth materials that predict good breathability and filtration. How fine is this line, and how many materials are you talking about?
There is this trade-off that we find between very breathable masks that let a lot of air in, but then as a result, let a lot of viruses out, or let a lot of viruses in, and very dense masks that, you know, if you think about a piece of saran wrap you wrap around your face, won't let very many viruses out, but also won't let you breathe. There's got to be a balance between letting the breather breathe and still being effective for filtering the virus. And that balance is not so straightforward. It's not so linear. So in our preliminary findings, what we're still putting together a bunch of research about is that there seems to be, for a lot of materials, a trade-off with more breathable means less filtration abilities, or more filtration abilities means less breathable, but not in all materials. There's some really fascinating materials where this trade-off doesn't perfectly correlate. Within the group of materials, we see some correlation. So for example, in a variety of different 100% cottons, we see some consistency. But if you move to a very different material like polypropylene, what's put into N95 masks or surgical masks, they don't follow the same trade-off trend as cotton. They actually are overall better. They generally seem to have much higher filtration ability for the same or greater breathability. So we're trying to understand what are the fundamental properties of these materials, their pore size, the thickness of the fiber, the type of material, so cotton versus wool versus polypropylene, and how that influences both filtration and breathability. And then using those fundamental properties of the material, see if we can provide simple and clear guidelines for manufacturers in a series of parameters we call industry descriptors, IDs, such as TPI or thread count. So everyone knows about Egyptian cotton has a very high thread count. Lots of manufacturers know about thread count as well. So can we correlate breathability and filtration ability to something that manufacturers know about, like thread count or type of material? We don't have a perfect answer yet, but what we do know is that the more occluded the pores, that means, or the more tortuous the pathways, in plain language, what that means is the longer it takes for a particle to travel through the material, the greater the chances are that that particle or that virus will be captured by that mask. And that's actually why polypropylene works so well, because it's created in a big, messy mat of fibers. And so it takes a long time for viruses as well as air to travel through this messy network. And that length of time increases the chance that it's going to get captured by one of those fibers. So at the beginning of the pandemic, when I got into this research, we didn't have any ways to test the masks properly. We just had our grit as engineers to build something with your generous help, John, and with McMaster's generous help. We built our first preliminary system, which advanced to our now much more sort of fancy system that's much faster to use. So at the beginning of the pandemic, our first system took about 2 or 3 hours to test one mask. Now we can do that in about 15 to 20 minutes. We have been working with a variety of companies that are trying to invent new mask materials, are trying to help get some mask materials certified to verify the effectiveness of masks that are already out there for healthcare workers, and in conjunction with Dr. Claes and a variety of other researchers, we've been testing the effectiveness of cloth masks that are out there in the public domain, as well as huge number of materials that you could buy from fabric stores like Fabricland or other big suppliers. So to date, we've tested over 170 different types of materials and about 30 different types of known well-made masks to give us a broad swath of what materials work and what materials don't. And we hope to have that published relatively soon. We're still finalizing some of those details.
You mentioned this tortuous path that takes place for a particle to get from one side of the filtration material to the other. Of course, depending on the size of the particle, the transmissions could be very different. So my understanding is large particles will be ballistic. And so you can almost look at a line of sight to see whether or not it has a chance to get through. But at very small particle sizes, they're going to have random motions take place just through their interaction with the air. Do you find a difference in terms of how the different sizes of particles are filtered, or do things more or less scale across all sizes of particles?
No, you're absolutely right. Like you mentioned, larger particles will be much more ballistic in terms of they will follow straight lines of flow more readily. So if you breathe in and out, the larger particles will just flow in that straight line. Whereas very small particles are not going to be influenced as much by that breath flowing in and out. They'll be impacted by what's called Brownian diffusion or Brownian thermal motions. And so they have a random motion as they travel from one place to another. And then there's these unique particles that are not too small and not too big, just Goldilocks particles, which are impacted both by diffusion, Brownian diffusion, as well as the ballistic phenomena, these flow lines. And so as a result, are quite difficult to capture. They're too large to be fully influenced by the Brownian motion, too small to be fully influenced by the ballistics. And so you need a combination of effects to try to minimize their transmission. And unfortunately, and probably some evolutionary biologists can speak to this, unfortunately, the coronavirus and its aerosolized form happens to fall quite nicely within this difficult to capture size. And that's why this research is not so obvious. That's why this research is actually interesting and complicated. It's because these particles are particularly difficult to capture and filter.
Myrna, you've been key in developing the testing setup to study how aerosols interact with different masks. What does aerosol testing entail, and where are we at now in testing for COVID-19?
Well, the setup that's described in the ASTM standard for bacterial filtration efficiency is specific in the equipment that is needed. So it involves cascade impactor, involves a mixing chamber, an aerosol generating device. Those are the main components. But beyond that, and beyond actually identifying the manufacturer of the aerosol generating device, let's say, there is little data on performance. So if you change flow rate, if you change pressure, if you change quantity of fluid in the reservoir, it seems to affect the performance characteristics, which means the exposure of the aerosol to the material you're testing will change. And so we're currently with my research assistant, Rod Rem, working out these details because we have to understand how the system works before we can be assured we're going to get reliable results when we're testing actual material. We're almost done, probably have another few weeks to go for the first setup. That is a setup for bacteria. And we can start then making measurements with actual face mask material. The second setup is for viruses, and it's a little different. Similar components, but the viruses are much smaller in aerodynamic size and physical size. And so we have to go through the same routine for them. The outcomes are slightly different. So we've been working on this, I think, I want to say since March, you know, which is amazing, given that here we are in December, but we were getting there.
The research has been very, very interesting. And of course, it gave me a chance to form collaborations with, you know, people like Myrna, who are experts in aerosol research, and, you know, for my lab to learn so much. Now, the capacity that I'm using these phages or these viruses is that they are surrogates. They are models for the actual pathogenic virus. And so we're aerosolizing phage. And using these aerosolized virus phage, we're looking at the filtration barrier efficiency of masks and their ability to actually filter out the viruses. And the phages that we're using, their surface structure is similar, their size is similar to SARS-CoV-2, their surface structure is similar to SARS-CoV-2. And so they're reasonable models for the infectious virus. Specifically, the part that we've been focusing on is we've been looking at the standard for testing the bacteria filtration efficiency. So the filtration efficiency of masks against aerosolized bacteria. And we've been looking at that in more detail from more of a researcher's perspective to find if there are any inconsistencies, any biases, and also kind of cross-checking that with a setup that we've put together for quantifying the filtration efficiency of these masks against aerosolized viruses, which is not something that there's no standard currently for this. The standards only call for bacteria filtration. So this is the part that we've been focusing on, trying to understand if bacteria filtration is actually a good indicator for virus filtration. And of course, putting together the test setup, the standardized test setups that are very important for this work. And of course, in the process, Myrna and I have formed a collaboration with the Hamilton Health Sciences, with the Canadian Standards Association, and are working toward generating knowledge that could inform the process of putting together the first national standard for testing these filtration efficiencies, because there is currently no national standard.
Okay, so since March, companies have been coming out with cloth masks virtually everywhere you could look. We're now well into, in Canada, this is the second wave of the pandemic. In the United States, they might refer to it as a third wave. based on the available research, what's the best cloth mask for somebody like myself to use when I'm going grocery shopping, visiting the office, or just going about daily life?
So I can answer this in two parts. One is the best masks to wear that you can readily purchase are still those made from polypropylene, non-woven polypropylene. So those often will look like those blue surgical type masks or operation masks that you can purchase. Those, based on the current evidence that's out there, based on our experimentation, those are still very effective. And all masks are better than no mask across the board. But if you want a mask that's going to be the most certain to be effective, those non-woven polypropylenes are going to be a very good choice. Unfortunately, those are disposable. They're not washable. And if you want a reusable mask, then what I'd recommend, and what actually Dr. Tem has recommended, who's the lead physician for Canada, is that you use a two-layer cloth mask. So usually a pretty good quality cotton with some sort of polypropylene embedded inside. And we recommend that, based on what we've read and based on what we're starting to understand, we recommend a variety of different non-woven polypropylenes, not just those that are destined for N95 or L3 surgical masks, but you can even use a non-woven polypropylene material that could be used in the undersides of couches, chairs, for example, that white fabric that you'll see at the bottom of couches and chairs, or what's used sometimes to stiffen collars or be incorporated into zippers. If you incorporate that into a two-layer cloth mask, this will make a very effective cloth mask. If you don't have access to that, then I recommend two layers of a good sturdy cotton, something you can breathe through, but something that's not as stretchy or fine as a buff, for example. A buff is not a very effective mask. Or a thin shawl or a too porous scarf. These are not very effective.
So thank you, Charles. Catherine, you wrote in a piece in The Conversation that imperfect use of imperfect masks can still have an impact on the course of the pandemic. At what rate of use do the masks become beneficial? Do they become less effective the longer you use them? How often should I replace mine after 10 washes, 30 washes, or can I just continue to use it?
If you look at the modeling paper by Stutt from very early in the pandemic, you can see that even 25% use of a 25% effective mask has an effect on the basic reproductive number. That's the R number that we have all been tracking so closely. The IHME, that's the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation in Seattle, they estimate mask use in Canada at 75% at present. They predict that if we could immediately magically increase that to 95%, we would prevent 6,000 deaths by the end of March 2021. So we still have leverage, we still have room to move the needle on that scale. We need all the leverage we can get, and we need it now, because those same projections show that as things are, if we just carry on with our 75% mask use, we will start seeing ICU and total bed capacity in Canada being exceeded sometime in January. And then the second question about washing your mask, we do hope to have really better answers to that in future, because at the moment, the answer is that we really don't know. We think it's probable that the breathability and the filtration properties of masks are changed whenever we wash them, but we don't know how to predict what that change is. It could make things better, it could make things worse. We just don't know. What I would say is that if you have a previously comfortable mask and now it seems hard to breathe through, just consider that maybe its material properties have changed and consider replacing it. Otherwise, what I'm doing, I wash my mask every time I use it, and I'm only replacing them when they're actually failing structurally. And that's the best that we know right now. There is a long-standing train of thought in virology and in the study of pathogens that the inoculum that you get, the dose that you get infected with, affects the severity of the disease. And using epidemiological data that's been accumulating during the pandemic, there is a group of scientists who have proposed that this inoculum dose affecting severity is actually happening in this pandemic, and that mask use and social distancing and all the things that we're doing to try and prevent ourselves from becoming infected are also perhaps having an effect on the severity of infection if we are unfortunate enough to become infected. And I think that that too, it's a hypothesis, it's not proven, but that too gives us some hope. And again, it brings me back to the idea that imperfect use of an imperfect mask is still a very good thing to do.
Zeynab and Myrna, in your view, what's the biggest public misconception when it comes to masks?
Yeah, I think there's a political side to that question. And there is a medical side to that question. I'm not going to go into the politics of it, but I think people have to recognize that masks are effective in blocking transmission of virus particles. It's a two-way effect. So they protect the wearer of the mask, and the wearer of the mask is protecting the person standing in front of them. And I think people have to be more generous with their understanding of helping their neighbor by wearing a mask. It's not forever. I'm hoping, and like everybody, that when the vaccine is proven to be safe and effective, that will put a major stop to transmission. And perhaps we won't need to be wearing masks every day. But it is an important part of this puzzle that mask wearing is effective and should be adhered to. I also think that we have to recognize that there are masks for the public, and these are cloth masks, and there are masks for healthcare workers, and those definitely are of a different quality of construction and protection. And there are still the same issues about wearability and reuse when cleaned and sterilized exist. And mask fit for different segments of the population have to be addressed. Masks are not designed for men with beards, for example. And we are looking into this as part of the CIHR grant that Zainab and myself received. So there are many aspects, and it's important, you know, at the bottom line, it's important to understand that masks are effective.
A small thing to add, I think one of the misconceptions is that masks can replace social distancing, which we know is not the case. They are very effective, but one of the things that I see with populations that wear a mask is you can wear a mask and then, you know, go into crowded areas and get closer to people, which at least the masks that are not well fitted, that doesn't seem to be the case. That's not what the data shows.
Charles told us a little bit about the propagation characteristics of particles depending upon their size. So can you talk about the strategies? People have talked about the length of time that you're near somebody who might be infected, the physical distancing that you have, the amount of time in a closed room. Where and when are cloth masks at their most effective? And where and when are there still concerns that somebody should not be relying upon a cloth mask to protect them?
I'm not sure we have all the data to answer those questions. I think, you know, if we're talking about airborne transmission, we have in the hospital particularly, we really have to understand the ventilation patterns in patients' rooms, in the OR, in the clinic. Are they sufficient to, in a sense, sweep any particles that may remain suspended in the air? They diffuse. These nanoparticles can remain in the atmosphere for long periods of time and travel with air currents. It's like smoke. You know, we use smoke as a test substance for nanoparticles, and you can see a smoke, but it doesn't remain in your line of vision for very long. And that's what happens with the particles that are exhaled that are within that size range. The others, and Charles mentioned the trough in the curve that occurs between sedimentation, not impaction, but sedimentation and diffusion. And it's a well-known observation, and it curves around half a micron down to 0.1 of a micrometer in size. And that borders both on the virus size range and the bacterial size range. So we have to understand that those particles will remain in the airstreams and look at the ventilation patterns in the room. And in schools, in grocery stores, where people are wearing cloth masks, we really have to either improve the ventilation, always open the windows and get rid of these particles. So ventilation is becoming a major topic of consideration amongst many aerosol scientists, and one that deserves good attention.
Zainab, can you elaborate on how your team is working towards developing a set of Canadian standards and that would enable the average consumer to know what kind of protection they're getting with their mask?
So what we've been doing in the past 7-8 months is when we started this research, Myrna and myself got in touch with the Canadian Standards Association. And of course, Myrna had been collaborating on other projects with the CSA before. And it turned out that the concerns that we had was shared by the CSA. And the concerns that we had was the standards that, we were trying to set up in our labs. They seemed vague and at some points inconsistent and at some points even dangerously biased. And so it turned out that the companies that we talked to shared the same concern. It turns out that the CSA has been hearing this from companies all along. And now we know that, you know, ASTM is also shares the same concerns. And so the shared concern brought all of us together in working towards now developing a set of national standards for testing the filtration efficiency of masks. And I want to emphasize these are testing the filtration efficiency of material, of course, testing the performance of masks. The standards had not been updated for a long time. They'd been revised, but not, you know, fundamentally updated for a long time. And this was a concern that everybody had. It's just that the pandemic mercilessly exposed this shortcoming. And of course, on the national side in Canada, it also showed us that how much we lack local knowledge, how much we lack the local knowledge, local infrastructure that we have inside the country so that we do not have to, in conditions where, you know, there are border restrictions, we do not have to rely on our PPE, our specifically our masks that are the most important line of defense for our frontline workers being tested in labs outside the country. And of course, being held in line because every country at that point prioritized their own personal protective equipment. That's really the concern that everybody had at that point. And 7-8 months down the road, this is really, the work is coming together. And we're sharing, so we're meeting with CSA regularly, Myrna and myself. We're sharing the findings. We're having discussions with them about what is it that they would like to see from the research side. Because, of course, there's a lot of non-academic work that needs to be done for standard development. We are sharing what we can bring to the table from their research perspective. And, of course, being part of the discussion there is good, and it's exciting for McMaster to be part of that discussion.
The biggest thing that I'm hearing about from my knowledge users and from my stakeholders is about standards. The eloquently about what's happening with standards and the interest that the CSA has in upgrading the standards that apply to personal protective equipment. But what we're also hearing is that level of enthusiasm may not translate into cloth masks. So what I'm going to prioritize next is starting that conversation with CSA and trying to communicate to them what I'm hearing from industry, which is that they feel it's not really fair that when they put in effort and they have materials tested and they try very hard to make a better mask, they are not allowed to make any claims around that. And of course, at the moment, with no standards, no claims should be made. Claims should only be made for things that are medical devices, and cloth masks are not medical devices. But other countries have already standards in place. The US, at the ASTM, we know that they are working on creating standards for what they're going to call barrier masks, which is these cloth community masks. And that will become a de facto Canadian standard in the way that Zainab explained the ASTM standards are our de facto Canadian standard right now for PPE, unless we do something. And I think that Canadian scientists and Canadian industry really should have a voice in setting Canadian standards for cloth masks. So that's my next priority. I think the interdisciplinarity of this whole project has its challenges, but the rewards are just huge. I was summarizing all this information with my epidemiology friends, and then I reached out to Myrna, and she took me seriously, and we wrote things together. And then she introduced me to Zainab and Charles and all the other amazing engineers. And since then, Darren Lawless has been instrumental in helping me to form a consortium called the Cloth Mask Knowledge Exchange, which is a stakeholder group. Everyone I've contacted has been so helpful and so glad to be involved. So it's COVID, and maybe people are more altruistic than usual, but I think my lesson learned is to write directly to people whose opinion I need. And I've just been amazed at how much people want to cooperate. And to my mind, this is how science should be done.
Myrna, what's been the most exciting part of the last 8 months for you and your research lab?
Well, I think it's being enmeshed in this area of research, investigating mask performance. I do want to reiterate that there are two aspects. There are masks for healthcare workers in the hospitals and masks for the public, which are cloth masks. The considerations are similar but different. The test methods are similar but different. And I think industry at the moment is involved in manufacturing for healthcare workers, hospital workers around the world, and the public and other manufacturers are caught up in manufacturing and designing cloth masks for public use. So I mean, it's been, in terms of my research, it's been a different aspect, but the techniques are similar. And it's exciting to see this evolve. And tools for manufacturers in Canada will be improved with a standard for that they can follow. And whether that would morph into a standard for other materials is unknown at this point. So it's an exciting area of research that I've been involved with, and hopefully we'll come up with some good answers fairly soon that will benefit, you know, both the manufacturing community and the public.
Excellent. Charles, Zeynep, you both pivoted your research priorities in March to focus on mass testing. Can you comment on the pace of this work and how is your research going to change once the vaccine is widely distributed and things evolve back to normal?
Once the vaccine is distributed, that's really not the end of this research. I can speak for myself. I'm just getting started. I'm sure Charles is the same. This is a very exciting area of research. And there are, the more you delve in, the more you realize how many questions are unanswered. And it's been largely, I'd say from the research perspective, it's been largely neglected to my surprise. Of course, there are, when it comes to aerosol science, there are so many other pressing questions that at the time probably needed to be answered. But once we find ourselves in the middle of a pandemic, then we realize how important it is to you know, focus on some of the more neglected areas that might have not been as pressing. When it comes to aerosolized bacteria and aerosolized viruses and how different materials respond to these aerosols, I think it really tied into to one of my research interests, which was to use these aerosols for inhalable delivery of bacteria and viruses, which I think my research could eventually morph into that. We have two meetings every week, just Myrna and myself and the entire team of you know, brilliant technicians and students that are working on this. And it always goes over time. There's so much to discuss.
I've been really impressed by how fast people like Zeynep and other researchers in the that were not related to this field have quickly adapted. I've been impressed in my own lab. You know, as professors, we advise, we direct students, we help them do the research, but the people actually in the labs doing the research are the students themselves, or the PhD and master students. And I've been really amazed at how quickly those students have adapted, have rapidly learned new techniques, have rapidly learned the literature. And this is going to be a substantial piece of my research going forward, because this is not the last pandemic. We're going to have other diseases, other viruses impact us. And the other side of that is that not only do we need to develop ways to protect ourselves until the next vaccine comes around for the next pandemic, but we have to recognize that the materials that we're currently dealing with are materials that were basically developed and optimized in the 1970s. And most of the focus has been on lowering costs. So we spend however many hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars training doctors so that we can put them in hospitals with 30 cent pieces of fabric over their faces. And I think there are ways to improve on that design, ways to make them antiviral, for example, or antibacterial, make them adaptive, tailor these materials for even more dangerous situations, for example, in hazardous waste sites or hazardous biological areas, and understand the material properties that will enable us to expand the scope and ability of these masks to a variety of different dangerous scenarios.
I can only encourage that, Charles. And you know, the other area are filters used in hospitals in the ICU, in dentist offices. You know, they need to upgrade it. You know, that they work, the ones that are there work, but I think we need to get the technology to really make them 22nd century filters.
Yeah, and make them reusable. Understand how cleaning impacts them, how to make them resistant to challenging cleaning environments, how to make them made from reusable or sustainable materials rather than materials that become hazardous waste, which you have to dispose of. Make these adaptive smart materials that can actually not just filter the disease or filter the virus, but actually detect if that virus is there and then perhaps inactivate it. I think these are the exciting future generations of masks and filters and separation media that us as researchers can really advance.
What keeps you up at night? So it's just, what's your greatest concern with how things are going right now?
I sort of answered. I said funding is a major issue for everybody.
My answer would be getting the research out to the public on time.
Catherine.
What keeps me up at night is not having enough money to buy a TSI 8130A.
That's a very nerdy answer.
I'm sorry.
Yeah,
it's a weird answer from a kidney doctor too.
Zeynab, I think we haven't asked you yet.
I think I have to agree with Charles. There is so much information that is being published both on non-peer review platforms and in peer review platforms. And I think getting the right kind of research out to the public, reliable research out to the public, I think that's really the most important thing. There's a lot of noise out there.
Got a couple other questions for the group. What advice do you have for students, engineering students, medical students, health sciences students, public policy students, who are interested in getting in this field of research?
There's a lot to learn, and you can't rush. You can't rush the development of a research program. So depends on what kind of student you're talking to. Medical students are different from public policy students, obviously, and health sciences students. So there's a lot of questions to be asked, and perhaps we need to delegate those questions to different groups of students that may or may not be interested in the areas.
I have to say, I've been amazed. I know Charles mentioned this. I've been amazed at how fast students that we've been working with adapted to the change of the research direction and the changes in the same research that we're working on, the daily changes and the needs that need to be met. And I think flexibility is one thing and staying curious is the other thing that I would recommend to students in general. So, and of course, as Myrna said, I cannot agree more. There's definitely a trade-off between doing reliable research and the pace at which you do that research. Of course, we need to, as I said, get the research out to the scientific community and the public fast, but it takes time to do reliable research. And so sometimes you can see both researchers and students losing patients, which can't be done if you want to do reliable work.
I do also think that we need more collaboration between Faculty of Health Sciences and the Faculty of Engineering. I mean, there is a lot of collaboration now, but these types of issues do beg the improvement on that collaboration.
I think this has been a true exemplar of how to do that collaboration right, something that maybe we hadn't done often enough before. We certainly have great examples, but not on the scale of this. What's the biggest takeaway you'll remember years from now about 2020?
You know, I'm going to go back to the students. I'm going to remember the engineering students and how hard they have worked, how they volunteered their time and skills. And as somebody that actually works in a hospital, their motivating problem to start with was to protect people like me and my patients. And they're still working. We're 6-8 months into this now, and they're still working like crazy. And we have to try and pull them back and get them to have some balance in their lives. So I just want to mention from Zeynep's lab, Lei Tian, who worked with me till 9 o'clock at night when we were trying to understand how to test cloth masks the way N95s are tested. And then Scott, Patrick, and Ryan. time that these guys have put in, their constant willingness to help, the application of the many skills that they have. That's what I'm going to remember.
I'm going to remember how flexible we can all be. It's unbelievable. We were, when you start collaborations, and I do collaborate a lot with people from with different backgrounds, and especially those of us with more expertise, with more experience, seem to be set in our ways, and see the problem from our point of view. So this experience has revealed to me how flexible everybody can be, and how fast we can move with the changing pace of events, if it's needed. So it's a model to keep in mind, and how well we can adapt to understand the same problem from the other person's point of view. And that's, again, the problem was changing and is changing by the day. The scope of the problem is changing by the day. And there are people with such different backgrounds working together, which could be challenging at the best of times. This has just shown me that we can do it. We can do it if we really want to.
I would have to second what Catherine has said. The students have really impressed me. They were adaptable, fast moving, energized and excited. And equally, I think the doctors and professors who all came together from different walks of life, different research areas, volunteering their time. I mean, this was not our research. I was really impressed by how many people came together for one focused goal. So I think it's the merger of multiple different disciplines. And also, even under very stressful circumstances, under long hours of working, how the respect for each other, the respect for each other's expertise, and the respect for the scientific process really shone through consistently. And that really will help develop better methodologies, better technologies, and safer responses to disaster.
One thing that we're doing in health research consistently now is involving patients in research. Not as participants, but as actual members of the research team, informing the research, helping to direct the research, helping the research to be on the right questions and done in a respectful way that's actually going to be feasible and work for patients who might have to participate. And I think this research is no different. So I'm looking for patient partners to help with research. I think those could be any members of the non-scientific community, but I'm particularly thinking about patient partners, because I think people who are living with chronic diseases or who are caregivers for people who live with chronic diseases have unique insights and motivation. So I have reached out to my kidney community and the CanSolve collaboration, which is a CIHR-funded national group. And I'm talking to them, and I'm talking to the Indigenous patient circle within CanSolve in the hope that I can find patient partners, and specifically Indigenous patient partners.
We'd really like to really plug our website, a website that Dr. Catherine Klase has put together called clothmasks.ca. If you go onto that website, you can find all about the latest research, the latest published research about how effective different cloth masks are, what are the most beneficial techniques for making masks, and what are the recommendations from a variety of health systems. So this is a very important website for people that want information about their masks, as well as to read our new publicly facing piece on The Conversation, which was released today, about recommendations using polypropylene and how that aligns with the Government of Canada and Health Canada's recommendations for masks. So go to these websites, clothmask.ca and The Conversation, which will help you get more informed about the best practices for masks.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Big Ideas for a Changing World. This show was produced by Jesse Park and edited by Dan Kim of the Faculty of Engineering. If you enjoyed the show, be sure to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or let us know your thoughts on social media. We're at McMaster Engineering on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. See you next time.